Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Decatur against Daniel. Mr. Richardson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court in this case found that there was no duty owed by the defendant, Kimberly Daniel, the supervising appraiser, towards the plaintiff investors. The brief of appellees suggests that everybody knows that appraisals are for the benefit of lenders and not for the benefit of purchasers. And I would like to point out that that theory is directly contradicted by Ms. Daniel's own testimony. When she was asked at deposition whether she expected anyone to rely on the appraisals that she signed, her response was, yes, the client would. Not the lender, the client. And that's at page 124 of the separate appendix. When asked how she would identify the client, she explained, the client is whoever sends you the order. And that's at page 123 of the separate appendix. As she went on to explain, the client may or may not be the lender. In that same passage of her testimony, she said the order could come from the lender or mortgage broker, as in this case, or it could come from the estate of a deceased person. It could come from a law firm providing representation in a probate matter. It could come from an individual who just wants an appraisal done. In all those instances, the client would be the entity to whom the duty is owed and who is entitled to rely upon.
Is a client somebody who hires you?
According to Ms. Daniel, the
I'm saying according to law, is a client somebody who hires you? If you have a client, is the client somebody who hired you as a lawyer?
Yes.
Can somebody else hire you as a lawyer for your client? Can you establish a client relationship without the client hiring you?
In this case...
No, I'm talking in your case.
In my case.
Yeah, because you use the term client.
Yes.
In a general sense. So client means the same thing in definition. Anyway, it's who hires you. It's your client, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Was this lady responsible to somebody who hired her or somebody else?
She's by her own admission, she's responsible to the client.
Who paid her?
She was retained by the trainee, Ms. Phillips.
So that's
to provide supervisory.
That's her client.
Yes, but I would point out that.
That's right, go ahead.
Okay.
Point out whatever you want.
Very well. In her deposition on that point, again, this is at page 124, Ms. Daniel testified, I understand that when I sign off on an appraisal for a trainee, that her signature basically means nothing, that I am fully responsible for that report.
I don't see, counsel, what any of this has to do with the case now before us. We have several questions of Indiana law. Whether Ms. Daniel understands Indiana law correctly or not seems to me entirely irrelevant. How do the Indiana courts understand Indiana law?
I would respond that the Indiana courts in no way disagree with the proposition that the...
What is your best case for the proposition that under Indiana law an appraiser is liable to an investor such as your client?
I would cite two cases, Your Honor. The Indiana Supreme Court's decision in the Cully case held that a seller's representations as to value of real estate may be actionable as fraud.
What does that have to do with appraisers exactly?
An appraiser is rendering an opinion as to value, and the Cully case establishes that such an opinion may be actionable as as fraud.
Look.
And the other case.
Look, counsel, there are two possibilities in this case. One is the appraiser is liable because there is some contractual responsibility. The second is the fraud possibility. Everybody knows about the fraud possibility.
Okay.
The line of argument you were making when I asked this question had to do with the first.
Yes.
Indiana is an ultra mares jurisdiction. It does not make lawyers, appraisers, accountants, and so on liable remotely to third parties. There may be exceptional circumstances. And, of course, the district court relies on Emmons against Brown,
yes,
which says that real estate appraisers aren't liable to third parties. The question I'm asking is, are there any more recent Indiana cases holding the opposite? Is there some Indiana case holding an appraiser liable to a third party?
The best I can point to in that regard, Your Honor, is the Real Estate Support Services versus Nauman case, which was decided 2 years after the Emmons decision. And in that case, the Indiana Court of Appeals held that purchasers of property could bring action against an inspector with respect to an inspection report that failed to disclose a defect in the property. The court specifically distinguished the Emmons case as being unique to the FHA context, as being a reflection of the concerns relating
to the inspector.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Who hired the inspector in Real Estate Support Services?
The mortgage company, Your Honor. The purchasers were held to be third-party beneficiaries in that case.
All right. So your answer to my question is no. There are no Indiana cases holding real estate appraisers liable to third parties.
I would agree with respect to appraisers. I would also disagree that the investors in this case are
properly
characterized.
We should then turn to the fraud question.
Well, there is a fraud question, Your Honor. There's also a question of contractual privity here. And the on the one side of the transaction, Ms. Daniel identified Novastar as the client.
Look, we've been through this. Whether Ms. Daniel correctly understands Indiana law is neither here nor there. I really do suggest you move on to fraud.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. With regard to fraud, the point that we would make in that regard is that reckless ignorance is sufficient scienter to support a fraud claim. In this case, Ms. Daniel signed off on a series of appraisals that were grossly inaccurate, and we would submit that the accumulation of circumstances is more than sufficient.
In what way were they inaccurate?
Have
you done a statistical analysis or hired a statistician to do an analysis of these things?
I don't know on what you're referring to as far as statistical analysis. There is evidence from another appraiser that the valuations were grossly inflated and that the methodology used by the appraisers was inappropriate and not in accordance with the standards required under Indiana law.
Of course, Indiana law says that appraisals alone are not actionable under a theory of fraud. Are you asking us to disregard that? Because your argument focuses on the appraisal itself and the method for the appraisal.
I would disagree with the proposition that statements as to value categorically are never actionable as fraud. And once again, I'd point to the Indiana Supreme Court's decision in the Cully case, which accepted as a general principle that opinions are not actionable as fraud. However, clearly drew the distinction that under given circumstances, the presentation of a statement as to value may be taken as an assertion of fact that can be actionable as fraud. The court noted particularly in situations where there's a differential in the knowledge and the person giving the opinion as to value is in a position to know value, and the person to whom the statement is given is not in the same position to make that evaluation.
Let me come back to my question. Did you engage a statistician to analyze appraisals? And it would be fairly easy to ask a statistician the question, are these the kind of errors that could have occurred by chance, or did they have to be deliberate? You could draw a sample of real estate appraisals in Indiana, see how closely they're correlated with the actual sales price, and then see whether the appraisals given by given or approved by Daniel are within the range of normal variation, or whether they're so exceptional that one has to attribute them to some kind of deliberate deceit. Did you do that?
No, there's no statistical evidence of that sort in the record, Your Honor. The what the record does reflect is that the valuations are anywhere from 2 to 6 times the actual market value.
Your complaint reflects that they are between 1.2 and 6 times the actual transaction prices, and the valuations of your appraiser seem to me completely loopy, because your appraiser was consistently valuing the properties at substantially less, like half, for example, of actual transaction prices. I don't see how properties can be worth less than they sell for in the market.
Well, in this case, the properties were sold for far above market value because the investors were deceived by...
Any such thing as things being sold above market value. Things are worth what they sell for.
You're into your rebuttal time.
I see that I am, Your Honor. If I may, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Richardson. Mr. Edgison.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Neil Eggison on behalf of Defendant Kimberly Daniel. There is one salient fact here that has been glossed over by the plaintiff and which, frankly, is critical to this court's analysis. The plaintiffs went into this illegal real estate scheme knowing full well that it was illegal and knowing full well that they were taking a risk with their money. Of all of the parties, all of the defendants, everyone involved in this transaction, the only person who had absolutely no idea that there was anything going on was Kimberly Daniel. So the real issue before this court is whether the plaintiffs should be able to recoup their losses from an illegal investment scheme on the backs of the one innocent party to this claim. In an effort to do that, they have adopted two separate tacts. First, there is the negligence claim, then there is the fraud claim. Taking the negligence claim first, there are three ways that they could establish a duty under Indiana law. It can either happen by contract, it could happen by common law, or it could happen by statute. And they throw all three of those against the wall to see which one will stick, but none of them do. Speaking first to the contract aspect, they argue that these appraisals somehow create a contractual duty extending from the supervisor of a trainee appraiser all the way through the mortgage broker, all the way through the lender, all the way through the agents of the plaintiffs, all the way back to the plaintiffs. As an initial response to that, it should be noted that of the 10 appraisals that are ascribed to Kimberly Daniel in this case, only 3 of them bear her actual signature. As has been established in the record, the trainee appraiser, Lisa Phillips, admitted that she modified information in 7 of those appraisals and then forged Kimberly Daniel's signature on them. Plaintiffs argue that that shouldn't matter. But that being said,
normal prices in this market for the service Daniel performed?
The normal market is she contracted with the trainee appraiser to sign off on these appraisals for a price of $50 per appraisal.
We know what she charged. My question is, what is the normal price in this market?
There is nothing in the record establishing the normal price. It's my understanding from speaking with Ms. Daniel that $50 is the fair market value for this.
I didn't ask her opinion whether she gave good value. I asked for prices. But if they're not in the if they're not in the record, they're not in the record.
There is nothing in the record as to that, no. So that having been said, with the three appraisals that actually do bear Kimberly Daniel's actual signature, and looking at those to see if there's any meeting of the minds between Ms. Daniel and the plaintiffs, one has to determine, okay, who are the parties to these appraisals then? None of the appraisals list the plaintiffs in any aspect at all. The client in each of them is the mortgage lender, co-defendant Novastar. In fact, the record is undisputed that none of the plaintiffs in this case had any contact or even had any knowledge that Ms. Daniel was going to be involved in these transactions. So because of that, that is one of the factors that the court in Emmons versus Brown found particularly important, Indiana Court of Appeals 1992, in determining where there is absolutely no contact or even knowledge that a particular appraiser is going to be involved. Between the appraiser and the purchaser. That is one of the factors to look at, and it is a dispositive factor in determining that there can be no tort claim there. That is exactly what we have here. Given that there's no privity between any of the parties to this, and given I don't know that I can add more to the independent contractor analysis that I've already provided to the court, but in order to establish privity, they have to connect the dots. And they've been unable to do so, especially considering that Lisa Phillips, the actual appraiser for each of these properties, was the principal, and she contracted with Kimberly Daniel to come in and take a look, review, supervise, and sign off on these. Knowledge, privity cannot be imputed from a principal to an agent. Privity and knowledge cannot be imputed from a principal to an independent contractor. Because of that, there is absolutely no way that the contract-based claim can survive. So if there is no contract, the second way in which a negligence or tort claim could survive is by common law. Here they have hung their hat on negligent misrepresentation. However, the Emmons versus Brown Court, Indiana Court of Appeals, has already spoken to that and said there is no such thing as a negligent misrepresentation claim under Indiana law against appraisers. That avenue is closed to them. That leaves, and the real reason oral argument was requested in this case, the idea of statutory obligation creating a tort law, or I'm sorry, creating a tort-based duty. Plaintiffs hang their hat on the Indiana administrative regulations governing the licensure and certification of real estate appraisers. And they argue that because there is language in those licensure and certification regulations indicating that whoever signs off on an appraiser's appraisal somehow accepts full responsibility for those appraisals, that trumps everything else, and it creates a private duty actionable at common law. That is their argument.
No, I don't think that's their argument. That's the argument you're replying to, but I don't understand it to be their argument. The private right of action comes from the common law of fraud, and we all agree that appraisers are liable even to third parties for fraud. The question is not where is the private right of action coming from. The question is wholly one of vicarious liability under a given established private right of action. That's the issue you need to address.
All right. Moving on then to the issue of fraud. Whether there can be a respondeat superior relationship actionable in fraud because of these regulations, it seems...
This is not a respondeat superior argument. Daniel is not the employer of anybody else. That's what respondeat superior is about.
That's correct.
Vicarious liability is fine, but it's not respondeat superior.
Fair enough. The issue in determining whether there is going to be actual fraud in this case and whether they can sustain their fraud claim really does hinge on the fact that this appraisal is an expression of opinion. And that is clear under Indiana law, under Block versus Lake Mortgage.
That has nothing to do with vicarious liability. You're now back to the argument that there is no liability for fraud. That's not what we're trying to pursue. We're trying to figure out whether, if there is fraud, your client is vicariously liable for it.
All right. And to the extent, then, that plaintiffs would rely on the administrative regulations to establish that, it is clear that licensure and certification requirements do not establish any kind of duty actionable in tort. It is
any case law in Indiana about this particular provision in the code?
There is not.
Is this common in other states, this kind of provision?
Indeed, plaintiffs have been unable to cite, and I have been unable to locate any cases in any jurisdiction in which...
That's not the question I asked. The question I asked is this kind of administrative provision common in other states?
Yes, it is. There are licensure and certification regulations in all other states.
Can we please be precise? I'm not asking whether real estate appraisers are licensed in other states. I'm asking whether provisions such as Section 3-6-9B are common in other states.
I will concede I do not know the answer to that.
Thank you.
Sure. Given that, and given that under Block versus Lake Mortgage, this is a statement of opinion, and they have offered nothing to this court to the contrary, and further given that there is no case cited in any jurisdiction in which regulatory certification and licensure requirements are transmuted from regulatory obligations into duties actionable in tort, they have absolutely failed to establish that they should be allowed to proceed with this claim. Because of that, because there is no privity of contract, because Indiana does not recognize negligent misrepresentation in the real estate appraisal context, because the administrative regulations are not actionable in tort, and because Indiana law is clear that a real estate appraisal is a statement of opinion, and consequently under Block versus Lake Mortgage is not actionable as fraud, for those reasons, we were entitled to summary judgment and the district court correctly granted it. Because of that, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Richardson?
Before you begin, I'm just curious. Why was Ms. Phillips dismissed from the investor's complaint?
I suspect we would have collection problems in the event of any liability. The deposition testimony was that she was not insured. And I suspect her resources as an individual would not be material in this context.
Have there been any criminal prosecutions growing out of this activity?
I believe not as yet, but it is it's in the air, to my understanding.
How long ago did it occur?
It was in the 2003 to 2004 time period, I believe.
Do you have a statute of limitations problem in Indiana on that?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm afraid I can't answer that. I would like to take issue with one comment made by Mr. Eggeson. He indicated that in connection with the question of privity, that Novastar was the lender in this case. That is not the case. Novastar was a broker. The district court found that with respect to obtaining the appraisals, Novastar was acting on behalf of the investors. The affidavits of each of the investors fully substantiate that indeed Novastar, through its employee Courtney Stocker, was acting as agent for the purchasers.
So do you know the answer to my question about whether other states have anything parallel to Section 3-6-9H?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I agree that licensing is common, and I don't know the specifics.
That's not the question.
No, I understand, and I don't know the answer, Your Honor. On the question of vicarious responsibility, I would again point to Ms. Daniels' testimony, in which she said that when she signs a report as a supervising appraiser, the trainee's signature means nothing. That is a correct statement of Indiana law as applied through the regulations that clearly require the supervisor to assume full responsibility. Now, why is there a regulation that requires a supervisor? It's to protect the public from inaccurate appraisals prepared by inexperienced trainees. The reason why Ms. Daniel was involved in the first place was because Indiana law requires a supervisor who has more experience and has fulfilled the requirements to sign off on an appraisal. When she signed off on the appraisal, she contractually, on the face of the appraisal, agreed to assume full responsibility for its contents. And on that basis, we would suggest that indeed she did have privity with the purchasers to whom the appraisal was transmitted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken.